Brigadier Clabby, Reel 5. Which stations did you prefer in India?
Well, I only knew three, really. Those were Quetta, which I found hot, barren, dusty, very fond of, full of sandflies, and rather claustrophobic, surrounded there by high brown hills. And I can't say that I rather liked Quetta. There was a sort of nasty feeling about it, and I was not surprised to hear a month or two after I'd left it that it had been destroyed by an earthquake. You had that sort of feeling of doom about it somehow. But Peshawar, after that, was lovely. Much greener, well-irrigated country, a much more cheerful environment, and everybody was very much more on their toes. Partly, I think, because you were on the frontier proper. You knew you were pulled out every month or so on these columns and pretended to be soldiers, and you had your hunting and your racing and your tennis, and it was a very popular station for the girls in the cold weather coming out from England. And altogether, I think it was probably the ideal station in India, with perhaps the exception of Rawalpindi, which I didn't know well, but was even more social and had the advantage of being very near the hills, very near the Murray Hills, which were the first step up into Kashmir. And you could get away and in your car and in about 2 or 3 hours be several thousand feet up out of the heat and the dust and the flies. On the other hand, I thoroughly enjoyed my time in Lorelei, which was a dear little station, one cavalry regiment, one battalion of Gurkhas, both extremely nice people, and although there were no social amenities, a little club to which I acted as secretary, which had its own tennis court, and precious little else, actually. And you had, as I described earlier on, your pet brigand to keep you busy. You had some extremely bad polo. And Fort Sandeman, 100 miles away, which one spent, or I spent, about 2 or 3 days every month in as a change. And, of course, that was a non-family station, and they lived in a sort of non-family fashion, sort of beating it up rather more than Laura and I, because they hadn't the wives to keep them respectful, and generally behaving on this in this rather public school manner which I had described earlier on. But I should say Peshawar and then Lorelei were my favourites.
You said earlier on that you had an Indian bearer. Did you have any other servants?
As a junior officer, I think everybody had their own personal bearer, and he went literally everywhere with you, including out on these frontier operations. Then you shared, each bungalow had its own staff, as it were, which you shared the expenses with the next chap. And this would consist of a sweeper, the water carrier, and there'd usually be a white night watchman who spent his time sleeping on the veranda. You very seldom saw him awake. And then myself, sort of having, using horses, you'd have one groom to two horses, something like that. Or perhaps, if you're being very rich, one groom to one horse. And these grooms were very good indeed. They really lived for their horses and kept them magnificently. And I think you can say this with all the Indian servants, that they entered into their job with tremendous spirit. Took it very seriously, let nobody else take advantage of you. They took advantage of you, but not badly. They were not dishonest. And they made certain that, as far as they're concerned, other people didn't get at you. No, they were, on the whole, thoroughly nice people. They'd disappear every now and again. Traditionally, they'd get a telegram to say that their house had fallen down and they must go away for a month, which was their way of asking for a holiday. I never knew them ask for a holiday if their house fell down. But they always came back again and always produced a nephew or someone who'd fill in while they're away. But to go on a little beyond our period, I was in India after the war, at the time of the partition, and to give you an idea how good some of these people were, I was up in Simla. There the Sikhs had took charge of the partition and were killing Muslims. And I remember one train, a little one-track and train coming up from the plains into Simla, and it was literally full of Muslims who'd been killed by the Sikhs on the way up, and their bodies thrown back into the train. So the train stopped running, and the only way of getting out of Simla was, actually, I got out in an army lorry. But it was regarded as, with my bearer, who was a little Christian Madrasi, but the Indians themselves regarded it as extremely dangerous to travel at that period. And I had my daughter, aged 1 year, in the charge of an ayah, who was deeply attached, as all the ayahs were, to their children. And she came and spoke to me and my wife and said, "You cannot take this child with you. It is too dangerous. My father is a farmer. He owns a little hill farm. I will take the Miss Saab and raise her as my own daughter, and she'll be quite safe and well cared for, and you need not worry about her." And I think this was very ingrained in the Indian character, that once you are accepted in this way, they would literally do anything for you. They were remarkably kind, loyal, and decent people. People of that stamp. You've obviously got exceptions.
What was your bearer called?
My pre-war bearer was Lal Din, a Muslim. He picked me up, actually in Bombay, quite like that. You know, they picked you up off the ship. I think he had they'd have dozens of references, of course. And he simply saw this gauche young man coming off the ship and looking round. Nobody met you off the ship, of course. You were just sort of dumped on the quay and had to find your own way. There was a letter telling you to proceed to A or B. You've no idea how to proceed to A or B. And a little gang of bearers, and I suppose rather like taxi drivers in England, they all took their turn. And this chap's turn it was to take hold of me. And I'd got the chap for 5 years, and he was very good. Saw me off at Karachi.
And you had a Christian bearer afterwards?
After the war, yes, coming back to India, I had a little Madrasi called John. And he again was in fact, it was, by then I was married, and of course John, with his Christian upbringing in Madras, was very knowledgeable and a very good man to have with a family. He spoke excellent English, which my previous bearer hadn't done. And when we finished up, we came down from Simla, as I was telling you, in an army truck with one chap with a rifle allegedly protecting us. Got to Ambala, actually, again, just to show you how lunatic the situation was. We got to a flooded river crossing, several lorries upside down in it, and there by that fall, by the crossing, were a gang of Sikhs who were hunting Muslims, quite literally. They had long spears and swords and were stripped to the waist. And they saw our lorry coming along, saw I was English, had a wife and child with me. My daughter, 1 year old, with very fair hair, very blonde, they thought was absolutely delightful. They were absolutely charming. They said, "What a sweet girl," and so on and so forth. "Now do be very careful how you cross this river." And they lined the river crossing so that we didn't miss the ford across and go into deep water, and sort of waved us goodbye. And these were chaps, I think. There was a little sanatorium not very far from there which took TB patients, and I rather suspect that it was that gang that had been in and murdered TB stations patients in their bed the previous night. But to me and my family, they could not have been more courteous and kind.
Did you have any personal preferences for any section of the Indian population, or any dislikes?
I don't think... I fear the people one rather did, I would say, dislike. But it was traditional, the military caste into which you were absorbed, as it were. Rather despised the Babu, the clever chap who sat at the desk and wrote out all the papers and sorted their pay and so on and so forth. They regarded him with deep contempt and suspicion. And I'm afraid this rather did sort of, although you regarded your Babu as a nice chap, you didn't really put him on par with the military caste, with the Rajputs and Punjabi Muslims and so on and so forth. And neither did they. They regarded him as, you know, really rather a dangerous, treacherous, difficult chap. He wasn't really. A lot of them would... just as decent as anybody else. But I think that I can't say that one really didn't get on with any particular religion or caste. I was more with the Punjabi Muslim types, but on the other hand, you met and appreciated, in fact, regarded them as extremely dignified and decent people, the Rajputs and such. Gurkhas, of course, were terrific value, though, again, the Gurkhas were very much apart. They'd be very kind and perfectly civil to you and do as you said, but they only rarely looked to their own officers. It was Gurkhas and Gurkha officers. The others, they didn't mind, they'd get along with, but they didn't take them seriously, and as soon as possible, they'd separate off. Be Gurkhas, and their officers became just as Gurkha as the Gurkhas, and this is the way things went.
Did you see much of the local towns outside the cantonments in places like Peshawar and Quetta?
Not really. No, you go through odd villages and so on, but they're very small villages. There was very little to see. You go out and see old ruins around Delhi and places like this. But I'm afraid one saw very, very little of the country as such.
Did you take an interest in Indian history and arts and crafts and so on?
History, certainly. But... not very much otherwise. I'm afraid I never got on with Indian music. It never appealed to me. And Indian carpets, certainly. I can't think of any modern Indian art other than carpets, that art form, that appealed to me at all. History, certainly, and certainly the sort of Mughal dynasties and things like that, I found immensely appealing. And the brigadier I had in the zone was a great archaeologist. And, of course, in that part of the world, Alexander had very much left his mark. And every place he'd be covered with mounds, and you sort of could dig into any mounds and find what apparently were bits and pieces that Alexander's troops had left behind. And my brigadier was always sending me... a tooth, and say, what does that belong to? And I'd have to sort of dig out anatomy books and say, well, that was a donkey or a horse or whatever. Probably so, but because I have no idea what sort of actual archaeological age the things were. But one certainly was, I was very interested in that sort of history, as I say, the Mughal emperors and Alexander and the extraordinary backwash from Alexander's invasion back into Asia Minor and Europe. It's fascinating, I find it.
Did you ever feel uneasy in any of the towns that you went into?
One felt immensely uneasy if you got into some areas of, I was trying to think of one place where I sort of... Some parts of Delhi, certainly. But here again, it was perhaps just one's own feelings. I was never offered any violence. When I was in Delhi after the war, I was stationed at Army headquarters in New Delhi, and I was living in a hotel in Old Delhi, about 5 miles, and I used to bicycle every day through the Old Delhi city, and never a hint of trouble, never a look or an arm raised. I think unless you met a riot situation, there seemed to be no real worry. I knew, obviously, looked out for what the equivalent of muggings and things like that, which you can find anywhere. But I never found any animosity against me just because I was British.
What was the demeanour of the Indian population generally towards you?
I think like any sort of people, if you went in the bazaar, they were after your money. You kept a tight hold on your wallet, and you never gave the asking price. You always learned to bargain, of course, and they always regarded this as rather fun, and you were an absolute fool if you just sort of gave the price they asked for first time. The ordinary people you met, they either ignored you or giggled or... I don't think they took any sort of great notice of you one way or the other. You were part of the landscape. Obviously, if you went into an out-of-the-way village, you were an object of curiosity, as you would be if you went to a village in Scotland or anywhere else. But oddly enough, I found I never had any trouble in this way. One could walk amazingly freely, pre-war at any rate. I think after the war it was different. I got a nasty feeling then that things had changed very much for the worse, and people were very uneasy. And I think life and property had become far less safe.
Did you enjoy your time in India as an officer or not?
I enjoyed it immensely. In those days, of course, one went out, or I think a lot of young men went out. They wanted to go abroad. It was the empire. My fathers had been abroad. And it was what life was all about. It was adventure, I suppose. Going back to India, not directly after the war, but I did another visit. I was in Singapore at the time, the middle 50s, and I went back to Pakistan, it was by then, to buy mules. And I thought, what a horrid, dirty, dusty country it was, and how uncomfortable, and how had I ever stuck it for 5 years. But I think that's just the difference that age makes to you. Of course, at that period, I was received with almost literally open arms. People were delighted to see you because you were British, not just because you were buying mules. And I did a 2-day journey on the rail by myself, and I met people were delighted. They said, "God, English, you know, fancy seeing you." And because they had a little restaurant car on the train, and they knew exactly what sarbs you ought to eat, and they came and insisted you ate. They hadn't got to be, by now being a thoroughly Muslim country, they hadn't got bacon. They apologised for this, but they gave you fearful-looking bloody eggs, which and things which they thought you ought to eat. No, they were terribly kind. But a very changed, different country, with a very different atmosphere. Very, as I say, physically uncomfortable. But no worse than it had been when I enjoyed it. It's somehow rather different.
Did you have much opportunity to meet Europeans in India who were not in the army?
Yes. Yes, one met quite a number of so-called box wallahs. These were chaps in business. Usually, of course, very much better off than the soldiery. But in the good old soldiery army tradition of those days, you held a box wallah in some contempt. I had a great flair friend, as a matter of fact, who, of course, with my veterinary outlook, he was the agent for Glaxo. And I got to know him through the sale of drugs and so on, because he was a sort of sole agent, I think, for India. And we became rather friends. But the army side rather frowned on this sort of friendship. You know, it was regarded as something rather unnatural and not to be recommended. They'd accept him, perhaps, in a drink party because he happened to be a chum of mine, but they didn't quite like it. I think they had received an Indian rather better, perhaps, than a box wallah. There was certainly that feeling there. But the severe, and again, you see, we had my father's old unit, the Indian police, we had an Indian policeman living with us. He was rather more acceptable because he was semi-military. The political side was regarded with grave suspicion. They were obviously extremely intelligent men, very much in touch with the local situation. But the military never quite trusted them. You know, they were regarded as a little bit peculiar. You didn't have much to do with them. It was a peculiar outlook, but this was it. And one didn't honestly see a lot of the civilian life at all. There were people rather apart. I think if you'd been in Bombay and Calcutta, it might have been different. But certainly on the frontier, they were a little bit frowned on.
What about the Anglo-Indian population?
Again, one didn't see. These were the chaps, you met them running railways and things like that. You didn't see very much of them. Certainly, it would be rare for them to mix in your little social world.
What was the attitude towards them?
Regarded rather like Babus. You know, rather soft, rather too well-read perhaps, rather too clever. Regarded with suspicion by Indian and British alike. Perfectly polite, but, you know, just not quite.
Whilst you were in India before the war, did you think, did you always accept it as completely natural that the British Army should be there in a foreign country, or did it ever strike you as odd that they were a foreign army in India?
Absolutely natural. And it seemed to be absolutely natural, you might say, to the Indians one mixed with. Again, to go back to the period of the partition, it was pathetic then how many people, I say, one was wandering around with an absolute charmed life in the midst literally of hundreds of thousands of desperate refugees, all the Hindu population trying to get south and all the Mohammedan trying to get north, and the trains as they passed each other would shoot people, would shoot at the train going north, would shoot at the train going south and so on. Ridiculous. But people would come up to you and say, "You can't leave us now. You must stay." And you'd say, "Well, you're terribly sorry, but you've got to go." But the feeling was never, certainly as far as I was concerned, that you must go, get out. Politically it was so, but as far as the man in the street was concerned, he was very worried indeed, most of them. One had, I remember when one got staging on that journey back to Bombay and the partition, one got from Ambala to Delhi, which was a city of death by then, smelt of corpses were in the streets and the back streets. A lot of looting going on, and there was an order in the mess, in the sort of transit center, very large letters, signed by the Indian brigadier commanding in Delhi at the time, ordering you to shoot, ordering British officers to shoot any looters or anybody causing a disturbance, and that there'd be an immediate court-martial for anybody who refused to obey that order. It was not, certainly not, a business of being thrown out. We went out, I wouldn't say as an honoured guest, but certainly as a departing friend, really. It was touching and really rather horrid. You really felt that you're leaving people in the lurch. A lot of jiggery-pokery went on, of course. There was a sort of... It was a tremendous opportunity for promotion, you see, for all the British getting out, so that all the senior jobs, all those that had been held by British, were then in the melting pot to be available. And as a result, you did get some people, some Europeans. I can't remember any British, but I can think of one European who became an Indian on the assumption that he would, that is, took out Indian nationality on the assumption that he would get promoted to a senior post. In fact, what he might have known, because he knew he'd been born in India and brought up in the country, he should have known that what happened was that his real Indian rivals would not have it. And he was last seen careering across the Sin Desert, I think, with these people in hot pursuit. And he got to Karachi unharmed. But there was a bit of a free-for-all as regards promotion at the end, but that didn't apply to British getting out. And, of course, some British were asked to stay in various key posts just for the period of handover, very often for, I think usually it was a two-year contract, something like that, just to sort of see them through a difficult period for some technical post for which they hadn't sort of properly qualified people.
Whilst you were there in the 30s, did you think that British rule was going to end soon?
One fully understood that the idea eventually was to hand over power to Indians, and that one's job was to accept and train up Indians to do the job you were doing. There was no question of that. But a little bit of opposition, well, quite a lot of opposition from the real old India hands, because they couldn't bear the idea of an Indian being in authority, and they couldn't bear the idea of being under an Indian. You know, this was quite horrifying to some of them. But in the end, it was accepted very well indeed. I didn't, to answer your question properly, I knew there would be eventually a handover. I thought it would probably take at least 20 years, be a very gradual process of education. But I always anticipated, I think, that there would be some measure of British influence in the form of dominion status. But it wouldn't be complete independence, in other words, that you would get a partnership. Now, I don't think I ever visualized a completely independent India.
Ever?
No. No, I thought of it more in the form of a dominion.